You are listening to Redefining Rural, a podcast dedicated to celebrating, elevating, and changing the way we think about rural education in the state of Colorado and beyond. Download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to follow us on your favorite social media platform.
I'm Michelle Murphy, Executive Director of the Rural Schools Alliance in Colorado. I am thrilled to be joined by my two co-hosts and partners in crime, Kirk Banghart of Generation Schools Network and Danielle LaPlatte of the San Luis BOCES and the South Central BOCES. Talk a little bit about Danielle's dual role and citing things she's doing around that. Then we've got one of our superstar superintendents, David Blackburn from the Salida School District. We are coming back, and we'll be back monthly, with a return to our focus on work-based learning and the important critical role that that plays for our students all across the state and across the nation, but particularly with regard to our rural students and the special challenges those programs present in rural, developing those programs present in a rural setting. All three, Kirk, Danielle, and David, are all involved in work-based learning programs. So I'm the only one who's not, but with my advocacy hat on, really feel like it's important that we talk about our students and their right to equitable funding and programs in this regard. So I think, David, I'm going to kick it off to each of you to introduce yourselves, tell us about your district, and then talk about sort of the work you've been doing around work-based learning in the last year or so. I think much of this work's been funded by our state's rural co-action grants, which we have talked about on this show before, and Danielle sort of single-handedly moved the Department of Education when she was with them. I think it's somewhere around $22 million that was distributed out of federal stimulus or COVID dollars. That funding is coming to an end. So let's start with the happy news and the importance of work-based learning, David, and some of the work you've been doing.
Yeah, we've had a lot of success in Salida. And it's not just work-based learning or just the rural co-action grant. So that's one lens that we look at. And I think that's important as other districts are considering these efforts, is how does it work all together? How does it work with maybe a counselor core grant? How does it work with your graduation requirements? I think it's really important if you're looking at it from a legislator's perspective or the Department of Ed's perspective or a Board of Education, you have to see this work holistically. And there's also a large equity issue that falls into this piece. So Salida, you know, we've had a very good run over the last decade in terms of, you're going to look at our test scores and those kind of things. We've had a very good run. It's been a strong setting academically, everything else. But what I always worry about is you did well in the tests. So you did well on the accountability measures. That's fine. I'm interested what you did afterwards. And so most of our energy is gone towards, are they our kids, are our graduates in college, in a trade certificate program? Are they doing that next piece? Or are they in the industry somewhere? Are they moving on and they're taking care of themselves and being great citizens? That's the key questions we've been looking at. So for us, you know, we'll be a district of distinction, I'm sure, again next year. I mean, I have no reason to suspect that, right? However, our matriculation's over only about 50%. And so those two things are where work-based learning starts to come into play, because we are seeing our students not engaging in the next step. And we know that in Colorado, that 90% of the jobs that are available that will keep you out of poverty settings, out of needing government assistance, require something after high school. So that could be a trade certificate, or that could be that classic four-year degree. So if that's 90% of the jobs my kids are going to need, and that's where the jobs are, and only 50% of our kids are being known to matriculate, even if you get into the matriculation, say, well, there's some more kids there that aren't identified, that's still just, that's a big number for us, a gap for us. So we've identified that. So we changed our graduation requirements. That was a very large, noisy conversation in our community. Because it's hard, because in order to grab hold of something new, you got to let go of something. And when you start letting go of something and you turn your sacred cow into a hamburger, there's noise. And I think that that's really important when we talk about this from a legislator or a state board perspective. Because if it's just work-based learning, we've been doing that for years. People call it apprenticeships, co-location. I've heard things all across my career. But if you're going to talk about saying our students really need to have that finishing touch of their education career with us in K-12, engaged in the workforce and seeing how their skills or lack of skills actually go into reality to make that transition into the next thing, that's why you got to believe in work-based learning. So it's graduation requirements, like we have a school counselor core grant. Well, that's tied into it because it's advisory. And then you want to talk about SEL, that's tied into it. Because the number one thing that our workforce here in our small town is they want more SEL because they're more concerned about our kids' soft skills, they'll talk about, right? But what we find is adolescents develop when they need to. It's a human development issue, and work-based learning has been powerful for us. We now have about 60% of our kids doing apprenticeships. So not just, I'll call it, work exposure, where they're actually just going, you know, to see mom and dad work, kind of shadow days. This is actually doing the work. So if they want to be a doctor, they're actually there helping deliver babies. If they wanted to be in real estate, they're actually getting their real estate license. If it's on more of the trade side, you know, we have got now certification programs in heavy equipment, and we've been building houses and doing other things and making those relationships with our workforce. But where our kids transform is when they hang out one-on-one or with a team in the workforce, and they're just part of working. And then they grow into these beautiful adults. And then the SEL makes sense. And then the counselor core stuff makes sense. And then the graduation requirements make sense. And the SEL and all those different regulated efforts make sense. And of course, rural co-action was something we were able to use to kind of get us jump-started. And we can talk more about that later.
Thanks, Dave. Danielle, 60% of your kids in apprenticeships seems astronomical. I think maybe because of where Salida is in the world geographically, and maybe that makes it, I don't want to use the word easy, but the challenges may look different. Danielle, you're in much more remote areas for the most part, the districts that you're working with. Correct me when I misspeak, for sure. But talk about what work-based learning and the work that you've been focused on has looked like with your communities.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Michelle. So I think the last time we recorded a podcast together, I wasn't even in the role that I am now.
I think
and
that's
so
right.
Over the past year, I've been able to assume the executive directorship of the San Luis Valley BOCES in addition to South Central. And so to provide just a little bit of context, in both of those organizations, we've served 26 member school districts and in a geographic region that spans about 17,000 square miles across the most southern region of the state of Colorado. Collectively, we serve about 12,000 students in total. And so I can echo so much of what David said when it comes to what we've been able to do and what we've seen in work-based learning over time. And I think from a BOCES perspective, what we are most interested in is the collaborative nature of this work and making connections so that we can actually affect students' ability to have opportunity and access. So to your point, Michelle, in talking about the opportunities that might be available in some of our local communities, if the BOCES acts as a centralized support structure in this work, then our hope is that we can create more opportunities as we develop more partnerships and develop some collaborative sharing models across both of our organizations. And so I think there are so many reasons we can talk or point to as to why this is the right work and why this is so region specific. Of course, and as you can imagine, in my organizations across, because we have so much geographic diversity, the priorities in all of our local communities can differ greatly. But I think at the end of the day, we can all agree that we want to provide the best opportunities and education for all of our students. And so this work allows us to do a number of things. And I think there is so much data that we could point to when we're talking about student engagement, attendance, allowing students when they are completing high school to have the opportunity of staying in our communities and entering into the workforce, making a livable wage. And so we've supported that work in a number of different ways across both of our BOCES organizations. And I think we always try to align our initiatives so that we're getting the most we can out of the dollars that we're receiving in terms of supplemental funding for any of the programs that we want to stand up. But Rural Co-Action has been a big boost. It's been the largest sum of money that we've been able to be awarded to really focus on all of the work-based and career-connected learning opportunities. And so through that, we've been able to have a number of school districts complete their graduate profiles. So as to David's point about really what the community wants, our school districts have been able to set a firm foundation for that. And then we've also been able to really get a good sense of what all of our districts are offering in terms of certification programs, dual and concurrent enrollment, internship and apprenticeship opportunities, and then really start having some conversations about how we can start to build some sub-regional hubs where we're able to start sharing some of those opportunities across our districts. A lot of the early work has focused on supporting districts in making sure that they have a foundation on which they can build. And so getting an internship structure framework in place, making some connections to businesses, just making sure that we're supporting our schools in that first step. And now that we're nearing the end of our co-action phase, really thinking about how we can start sharing some of that across our entire region. I think anytime that we're going to start structuring new programming and want to really expand that, we have to have an investment. And so the co-action money has been great in helping us to jumpstart that. But in terms of sustainability, we're really looking for a sustainable funding model that will continue to allow us to do this work. And so I'm not too sure how much we want to start talking about the challenges that exist, because there are so many bright spots. But in order for us to continue to do this work, we're going to have to continue to invest in the work itself.
Yeah, we're going to dig into sort of the current funding model, blessing and a curse, because it's really moving mountains, quite literally, in both of your communities. Kurt, talk a little bit at GSN. You all are supporting at least two regions with some of their co-action work. Talk a little bit about what you all have been working on.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think it's as the work that we're doing, much like what Danielle described, one of the things that we find is that as our small and isolated districts face is that as you look regionally, one of the things that our small and isolated districts face is that to be able to leverage the work that we do in this space is really, you can't do it alone when you're small and isolated. So you have to be able to come together, and that's where the collaborative's work has really been able to be able to look at how do we come together to be able to do this lift. And I think the work that we see that David's district is doing is fantastic. And I think a lot of kudos go out to Salida School District and what they've done with their partners, their university and higher ed partners, their business partners has been fantastic. When you look at what that looks like for those regional areas that are further away from a higher ed partner or business partners, part of that means that you've got to look to another district to be able to do that when you're really small or really isolated. And so part of the collaborative has been able to say, how do we come together to be able to become an economy of size, to be able to do similar to work of what we're being able to see in that. And so I think that's part of what we see with the coaction dollars has been able to be able to bring people together and have an organization like the Collaborative to help facilitate that work to come together. The other pieces that I think that we've been able to see that Daniil was kind of alluding to as part of this is that conversation of that foundational work that a lot of these districts have been able to do with these dollars to be able to look and interact with their communities around conversations of things like, what is your portrait of a graduate? What are your North Star skills or your durable skills that people are really saying, what are the skills that kids need to go into the workforce? Because a lot of our districts are doing fantastic work around what are the state standards and what are the academic skills that have been set forth in our state standards. But a lot of our business partners are saying there's also this work around these skills that students are needing when they come into the workforce, which aren't necessarily called out. And so how do we identify those and then be able to ensure that those are happening when they do that? And so a lot of that work is to try to identify that with our workforce partners and then be able to make sure and ensure that those are taking place as our kids are coming into the workforce as they're doing that. And so it's not just about reading and writing, even though we know that that's a critical part of the work that schools do, but we're also helping build some of these other durable skills or North Star or portrait of a graduate, whatever term you'd like to do it. I think to what Daniil was saying is that these foundational pieces that we put in are really systemic because it isn't what schools had been for many years set up to do. And so this is where I think these dollars have been put into place to really help make sure that we have the systems that are in place to ensure a lot of these internships, these mentorships, some of these things that have allowed students who aren't necessarily going into post-secondary in the four-year college track or looking to do it, that those systems are in place for them to be able to do that and ensure that they have a robust way to have a career-connected learning take place in their K-12 experience so they can do that. And so these funds have really helped us hold and stand those up, not just in single districts, but across multiple districts so that they can work together in doing that. And so I think that's where really sustainability is kind of this question that we have is that now that we've set up this foundation so that we can really help a lot of students have some exciting experiences and be ready for the world that they're entering that is very different than many of us when we entered the workforce looked like, but then how do we sustain that now for them, for the next group of kids that are coming in and not that this wasn't just a one shot per time for them to do that. And so I think that's what's exciting about what the coaction grant dollars did. And now it's really how do we continue that on and make sure that that's there for this next group of kids that are moving in to our schools.
And can I think that's a great next question, right? Like, how do you continue that on? What is that going to look like in Salida and in South Central and San Luis? Like what? And I know I've talked to all of you about the frustrations around these grants don't build our local capacity in the way that they're structured for a myriad of reasons. How are your areas, and Dave, let's just start with you to keep our rotation. What are your next steps for next year with the coaction funding drying up, but the great achievements?
I think that's great. I think there's two different ways that I think about the sustainability problem, particularly in a rural, right? And we are a little bit bigger than some of the places where Daniil is working at. You know, that's, I always
how
think
many
of
students,
all the
Steve?
Rural. We have just over 1,000, so we're about 1,200, right? So we're big enough to have a Walmart, where a lot of the other districts that Kirk and Daniil are working with, they're not big enough to have a Walmart, right? We don't get a Walmart and a Target. That's a different size district, right? We get one little shopping store, but it gives us options. But there's two different aspects of sustainability that we have to think about. And I think sometimes we focus on the money, we miss the other one. So I kind of want to backtrack.
Please.
For me and my community, we talk about the durable skills. I'm glad Kirk, other people are using that term, trying to, you know, deal with this. But my businesses come in and they're frustrated because they might hire one of my students and they feel like they don't have the resiliency that they need. Or they might mention one of the other durable skills that they're interested in. Work-based learning has allowed us to share the responsibility with our whole community of raising up and developing humans. Because a 17-year-old, it doesn't matter whether it's 1980 or 2024, still has a basic cranial rectal inversion issue. They're in late adolescence, and you can't make that go away by some fancy legislation or by dropping a bunch of money on it. There still is human development. And what has been beautiful for our work-based learning has been now my one engineer in my town who's working with distance. We've been able to put a kid with them, and he's helping that kid go through that human development and helping them learn those skills. And now he's part of the school mission, because I think in rural and in K-12 education, we keep stepping into the gap and saying, we'll just take care of that. Hey, send us a grant. Well, the problem is, it's all of us have to step into that. And my Economic Development Corporation has been a key partner. And then we were able to bring in for us, it's Colorado Mountain College, making those big key partnerships to say all of us are in this transitional part of that kind of 16-year-old plus. And that has become sustainable. When I now have over almost all of my businesses in town saying, send me a kid, now I have a sustainable system. I still have a financial problem, but it's not just me, K-12, taking it all on and saying I'm 100% responsible. Because then even if you could find a way to give me the money, I can't sustain that effort. I have to have Main Street, and I got to have my distance workers, those people who are in our mountain communities or other isolated communities in Colorado. There is no model from the Front Range that will ever work sustainably. I don't have an industry partner that I can just send 20 kids to every year, right? Because I can't make a plumbing, right? I can't make a plumbing program. I don't need 10 plumbers next year. I need one new plumber next year for 10 years. And that's, so I can't, and there's not a plumbing company out there where I could say 10 kids every year are going there and going through this pipeline. It has to be my plumber taking a kid every year and seeing if they have an aptitude, interest, and abilities in that trade, as an example. That is what is so hard about the sustainability thing. I don't know if Kirk or Daniil, you've seen anything about that aspect, because then we do have the funding problem too, but I think the other piece is getting Main Street sharing our problems.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think for us in some of our smaller schools and their end sizes, what is challenging is finding opportunities that align with those students' interests. And so as we dig into more of the career exploration and find out what kids are really interested in doing, providing that match in the communities is sometimes difficult. We're also thinking about how we can duplicate some of the experiences that our kids have in brick and mortar in an online environment. So we have a school district right now that has an online school as well. And so we've been in much of that same conversation with them about how this might work in an online environment when you have students spread throughout the state of Colorado, and we want to make sure they have those same opportunities. And so I think the work is really complex, and it looks very differently, I think, almost in every community because of the access, the geography, what businesses might exist. The challenge of finding industry partners is very real for us as well. So when we've been looking at some additional funding streams like Opportunity Now and having to provide actual industry partners, really thinking through the best fit and who might be able to act as an industry partner for us, I'm sure is a very different conversation for us than it is for others that are closer to the Front Range. And so I think this work has a lot of complexity. And I think in our school districts, that's why it's important for us to make sure that we're all on board with these efforts, because it really does take everyone working with the community in a way that's different from what we've been able to do in the past.
And I think, David, to your point, is that that's where community partnership becomes so critical. and making sure that ability to have liaisons into the community and work with the community becomes really critical. I think that one of that whole idea about interface with what are the critical North Star durable skills and what people find of value in their employees and what are the skills that kids need coming out beyond the academic components is really where I think we find that work becoming that interface component being one of the areas that we find that we really have. The other thing that we're finding a lot in our rural communities is really the succession planning, because I think we're seeing a lot of this, many of our baby boomer generations are looking at what does transition of their legacy of their businesses, what does that look like? When you're looking at things like, what does small repair for washer and dryer, those kind of things, those employers are looking at transitioning, or those people are looking at transitioning out. And unfortunately, there isn't folks to come in because we haven't looked at succession planning. And so how do we help support them in what does that look like to help get kids who may or may not be interested in that? And so I think having that interface between the schools and small business in small communities is really critical in doing that. So I like your point of saying, I'm not needing 10 plumbers. I'm needing one plumber for multiple years. And I think we see that in a lot of that, because we're not able, as some of our metro area colleagues are able to do, is saying we're needing a lot of X. We're needing a small amount of multiple disciplines, and how do we help provide that workforce? But the other thing that we're also seeing is that we know that importing our talent is also in our small, rural, and isolated communities isn't also necessarily an ideal, because a lot of times what we see is then some of the challenges that we have in small communities is that when you bring someone in from a metro area, some of the things about being able to commute, only having one store like a Walmart may not be ideal for someone who's used to living in a metro area. So how do we train kids who are used to the lifestyle of small rural, who enjoy that? How do we help them adapt to the skills that they need versus do the vice versa? And I think that's where we're able to really train them up to the skills that are needed versus the other way around. And so I think that's what we keep hoping is really the better way to really sustain our small communities than trying to do the other way around.
So the sustainability of the partnerships, and it's really an interesting perspective with regard to rural. It's like it's more work, fewer kids to place, but more work, because you're sort of one-upping on these smaller businesses and your local need. Is that bringing it back to capacity and sustainability for next year without any grant funding for this purpose? Is that your existing staff able to maintain those connections, or because that's a whole job in and of itself, I would think. So how does that continue on? Or are they so dug in at this point that it lives on its own, so to speak?
So I'll start off again. I think that is the key question. That's where the co-action grant money does come in. It's not just that. It's if I change that, even if I just change that liaison, all that relationship work, mm-hmm. they're not trying to have one industry partner that they have to develop a great program with. They have to have 100 partners. That takes years sometimes, particularly if you look at the geographic spaces that Kirk and Daniil are trying to talk about. The relationship building there is very, very hard. So that's where our dollars went to, was that liaison, that person who would help us connect with the community and place those kids one off, as you called it. And I think that's what's most at risk right here. And I think now that it looks like, you know, the legislator's not interested in keeping that money moving, right? It gets frustrating, because if I lose that piece, I retreat back to not what I could dream of, but what the capacity of K-12 in rural America can do, which is so much less, right? And so it's not a glorious investment of a whole new building or this some sexy program. And it's one person who has a relationship with my community and can say, I've got a kid who's got an interest, right? And I think you'll enjoy them. And then we have community. And that's the reason, you know, Kirk, we talk about why do people leave the Front Range with a lot of its, we'll say, you know, amenities. The reason is community. It's that I'm connected to everybody at Main Street. You know, if I go to Walmart, I get to have a parent-teacher conference, whether I wanted to or not. And there's something wonderful about that. And my kids are known, and I know everybody else's kids. And that's called community. It's being known. And in our urban settings, you know, that's one of the things that is a struggle for mental health. So I just want to say that that's where that Rural Coaction Grant, because if we're right now trying to figure out how we're going to backfill that position, if we lose that, we start all over. And my industry partners, my plumber doesn't have time to learn a new person every single year or a new paperwork because a new person came in and wants to do it a little bit different. They just say, you know what, I don't got time for this, and they walk away. And now I'm back to trying to take care of the whole lift of that transition from K-12 to the workforce or to some sort of training program. And we haven't been highly successful in that. And so I don't want to go back there.
Anybody else want to weigh in on that? Everybody's nodding their heads.
Well, I think from my perspective, it looks differently across both of our organizations. So when we're looking at total investment, in the Valley BOCES, I want to say that there was about an $850,000 investment from Rural Coaction because it was a project that was funded in one of the final rounds. And so keep in mind that with those dollars, we are essentially serving 14 school districts with that work. In the South Central BOCES, we were funded $2 million over 2 years. That was split amongst 12 member school districts. And so when we're thinking about total investment, we're looking at a little under $3 million that was invested into these districts, but 26 school districts. And thinking about how far that work goes when we have so many more partners that we're working with, although we were able to do a lot in terms of foundational programming,
can you explain what that means, foundational program? You guys have used that term quite a bit. Talk a little more.
Yeah, I think for me, it means that we're making sure that we have the pieces in place where we can start to build systems around those. So work like establishing a graduate profile and being clear about what we want our graduates to have when they leave those school districts. Making sure that we have an internship framework so that when districts are ready and kids are ready, they have a way to get kids connected to businesses. To David's point, making sure that we have someone that's connecting to our businesses in the communities and starting to build relationships within our communities with IAGs, with other partners. I think the struggle for us is that as a BOCES, when we want to build additional programming that is outside of special education, we have to look for supplemental dollars in order to do that. We don't have a local budget to support that unless we want to increase assessments to our districts. And so really what ends up happening with our grant funding is that we're able to support or at least get that programming off the ground, but then we're constantly trying to figure out how to build the bridge before we come to it to continue that work. And so what ends up happening is that because of a lot of the timelines for these grant programs, the work is very much tied to the grant. And so in terms of building any local capacity and getting someone on staff that's committed and dedicated to that work alone, we have to be able to have a multi-year plan. It's really difficult to hire someone by saying, I know I can fund this position for a year, and then beyond that, we're not sure. And so that's really the struggle that we face in not only work-based learning, but in many other areas as well. We're trying to do critical components of our work, and we're piecing it together with supplemental funding because we just don't have a funding model that can support all of this locally. And so I think that is our biggest challenge across both of our organizations.
Yeah, and I think what's what we're seeing, and I think we're all, that's the struggle that we're all facing, both as we look at it as collaboratives, as individual districts, is that one of the things that these grant funds did is it exposed a greater weakness in our finance structure for education as it, of overall, is it exposed one of these areas that we know are communities want in our business, our businesses need, and our students desperately want in order to have a better future. And we were able to prove with these funds that this is the correct work to do for a great group of kids. And so there, we proved that this is the right work to do. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is that because it is grant funded, it sunsets, we're all facing this piece that said, that work is proven, it's the right work to do, and now what? And so unfortunately, when grants come to an end, they're built as it falls back on the school district to continue the funding. And unfortunately, under our current finance model, the districts don't have money to backfill that without our legislature coming in and either increasing district funding to do that or continuing grant funding. And unfortunately, neither one of those is coming to fruition as a way to do it. And so we're all struggling with how does that vacuum get refilled? And then in the end, the people who are going to be are impacted are our students, the districts, and our business community in what's been built, which is some great work that I think we're all seeing firsthand really made an impact on those three constituent groups. And so I think that's what we're facing, which is saying this was the right work over this 2-year period of time where this money made an impact for those folks, and then how do we do it? And I think that's what we're struggling with, is saying we know it's the right work. Now, how do we find it when that continuous, sustainable money isn't there for us to continue the work?
What's interesting is for folks who are listening, some of this is created by some of this deadline or problem is created by the fact that the federal dollars come with a spending deadline of this fall of 2024. I'm pretty sure, at least I think, Danielle, I remember you saying, if we didn't have that deadline, we could fund, at least while it's still temporary, we'd have another year for some of these positions. But instead, we were forced to put money out in different ways just to meet those deadlines. So that feels unfortunate and contrived, and yet another problem with regard to grant funding. And so too, Danielle, you mentioned your Opportunity Now grant. Danielle was able to secure additional grant funds, but that isn't going to, sometimes when grants come with their own expectations for how they're going to be spent. And it's not the district's priorities that get moved forward all the time. Sometimes they align, and that's a beautiful thing. But when they don't, parts of programs will be cut because the state sees a benefit in one area and another. And I do just want to open this up. I think it's important for folks. We talk about it all the time, but they don't hear it from you all. What is the problem with grants? You talked about inability to develop local capacity. What else? I think I've heard you all speak passionately about the inequities created by grants, and it feels really relevant here. I want to give you a chance to do that again.
Well, for me, it's a long list. We've worked on a number of grants this year. And because our staff is small, it creates a great administrative burden for our staff. And so anytime we are spending days, am I freezing?
Nope, you're good.
Okay. Anytime we're spending a significant amount of time and effort on grant applications, narratives, budgets, all of that takes away from our original focus of the work that we're meant to do. The grant reporting has also become a significant burden. And so though we're really excited about the fact that we're able to extend a lot of this because of the Award of Opportunity Now, for instance, that's just one initiative. That is one program that we're working on. And now we're going to shift away from everything we did with CoAction in terms of the data collection, the reporting, and now moving it into a different model and different requirements that are specific to Opportunity Now. And so our internal staff is having to make that shift and getting ready to now transition into this opportunity now phase. So making sure that we're closing out all of the work that we did in co-action and now looking to opportunity now and figuring out what all of those requirements are going to be. That is for work-based learning in itself. That isn't touching BEST grants. That's not touching any type of literacy grants that we're applying for. And so really when we're thinking about all of the work that we're doing to support education for all of our member districts, it's just the reliance upon grants it's problematic for sustainability. It's problematic for capacity building in our own staff. And at the end of the day, it takes our focus away from actually working on the programs themselves and instead just spending so much time crafting these applications, working on the reporting, making sure that, you know, we're covering all of those bases so that we can continue to be eligible for funding. So that's just I think in a nutshell, like those are the highest level challenges. But I think we could spend a whole lot more time talking about our reliance on grant funding and the challenges that creates in our systems.
Anybody want to add anything to that? It's sort of in terms of high altitude, it doesn't get much better, but.
Well, and I think one more thing I can say about it too, is that we're forced to prioritize. Do we want to do X or Y? And sometimes that's a really hard decision to make when we know that we have limited capacity on our staff. Should we pursue this grant or this grant? Can we meet the timelines? The timelines are another thing that are often problematic. Sometimes by the time the application is released and then we have to gather information from 26 school districts about whether or not this is something we want to pursue and the planning phase with that, we're just really limited, not only with staff capacity, but also with time and meeting the requirements that a lot of these grants require.
I don't want to go too long, but I can talk a while on this, because for me, this has become a place where it's unethical what the legislator is doing. It is becoming an immoral thing on lots of different levels. So I think Danielle hit a lot of things. So just to extend in some of the places, I know that what makes a difference for a kiddo, for a student, doesn't matter whether it's a Front Range urban district that's highly impacted by different poverty factors, or if we're working with somebody in a rural, small rural particularly, who has impacted by high poverty issues, the difference is that teacher and that kid. Well, that teacher and that kid, that grant gets in the way because it is one more thing to manage. And then you want to tell me we're short of teachers, but would you pick up one more thing? Because if you pick up one more thing, I'll give you an extra dollar, right? And it's criminal what we're doing. And I could double the salaries of my teachers today. Throw me millions of dollars and I double it. They still can't buy a house on that salary in my town. And I know that that's true across Colorado. So one of the things is not just I have to chase that salary and try and tackle it and try and figure it out and do affordable housing. I'm in all that. But more importantly, I got to figure out how to make sure it's an enjoyable job. So that teacher wants to be with that kid, whatever the age developmental space that they're working, because if they're enjoying it, they might stick around and keep on being a teacher. Grants do the opposite of enjoying the work. When every single year, it's a different report for who? For the kid? No, it's not for the kid. It's for trying to keep the money flowing, right? Because we're throwing pennies in front of teachers and making them pick them off the street. And we're wondering why they're not interested in the profession. And then on top of that, right? I have a Walmart. I'm a little bigger. I'm rural, not small rural. What does that mean? It means I have a person who does grants, right? Small rural, not even a possibility. So that means I chase every grant. That means I win every grant. So in this game, if those are the rules, right? Fine, we're winning every single grant. Now I'm spending somebody all the salary goes to that management. You put more grants out, right? I'm gonna have to chase that and that management piece. But here's the thing. So now my district is gonna get those extra little dollars, right? And Danielle's going to represent 20 plus districts, right? That means those dollars are further away from those kids. And if we're going to make a difference for the kids in rural Colorado, you got to spend that dollar as close as you possibly can. Me as an individual district, I'm one step closer than Danielle is, or what Kurt's doing with his teams. And so I think there's also just an unethical aspect there where I'm getting access to dollars that some of Danielle and Kirk's member districts aren't going to get access to. So I'm going to get another step ahead. And we start to see inequities continue to grow in that way because it's grant funded. And then you put the sustainability piece, which pulls the carpet out, or you're just always chasing that dollar that's thrown out in front of the street. So those are some of the things I think we sometimes fail to talk about are the inequities. And if we're going to keep a teacher workforce and we're going to talk about who gets the grant dollars, that's not fair, right? So Salida might be winning in that game, but that's not fair to all the kids in Colorado. And so I think there's a real inequity issue. And so it's hard for me to listen to a legislator that is passionate about equity issues and then continues to stab the kids in the back in that way. And I think there's one last thing we got to tell. I'm looking for a representative to say, we can't afford that regulation. We can't afford that expectation. We got to trim back to what we can afford. If you can't afford work-based learning expectations and matriculation, then say it out loud. I'd love to have some honesty in that conversation. If we can't afford it, then say it. What can we afford? And let's make sure every single kid in Colorado gets that same thing.
Yeah, I think you guys have alluded to it, and I couldn't agree more in terms of the moral imperative to find sustainable funding for things that are currently funded by grants like literacy programs. Most, if not all, of our behavioral health supports, 2 million here, 3 million here. Work-based learning, we have like 5 or 10 million for $1,000 incentive grants for each kid you get through, but there's too many folks applying, so they're now $400. You know, I mean, we're just woefully underfunding. The inequities created for rural districts who more often than not don't have the positions that David's talking about with regard to the grant writing are, it's shocking when you come down to it. And I think for the to end on a high note, Danielle, you were just in Texas, and I think part of your opportunity now, Grant, is in partnership with the Texas Innovation Zone. She was sending, you know, clips of here's what this district's doing, here's what they're doing. Talk to us a little bit about what sustainable funding affords kids in really remote rural districts.
Yeah, I'm really excited for our partnership with the Rural Schools Innovation Zone in South Texas. They've done some incredible work in a really short amount of time, and they've signed on as a formal partner in our work with Opportunity Now. But I think what's different about the Texas model in Colorado is that when the zone was actually created, which was a collaboration of three very small rural school districts, their legislature passed on $10 million to start the zone. And so when we're talking about their funding model versus Colorado, we are almost on different planets. And so they have found ways to sustainably fund that work across the state of Texas. And I think when we look at the opportunities that are available to students there and how they're currently funding all of those models, we are in very different places. And so to David's point about just the ethical obligation that we have to students across the state of Colorado and how we're funding education, I think we need to be looking at some different models, especially towards sustainability, because I'm just not sure how we continue to make choices between whether we're going to afford kids a secure, safe environment for learning or work-based learning opportunities, and we shouldn't have to make that choice. And so, yes, we're super excited about the work that we're going to be doing, and I hope that's a model that we can learn from to further influence our funding model in the state of Colorado.
Thank you all. Yeah, I didn't add school safety to the list of things that you're forced to, not too important that you're forced to apply for grants, competitive grants to implement. Well, you all are amazing, and the work that you're doing is amazing. We never want to leave our listeners with this idea that the rural kids are getting any less than the best possible opportunities, and that's because of your great leadership and that leadership and your role-alikes around the state. We look forward to continuing these conversations on our Redefining Rural podcast. We are back. And please reach out any questions. If you're doing some great work in your area that you want to highlight, we really want to hear from you. So thank you all. And thank you all for taking the time to be here today. All right. You guys are